Welcome to Sate.
Okay.
A podcast about the foods that have shaped Malaysia. I'm Dr. Nobby Leong, scientist, food writer, and broadcaster.
And I'm Philip Gibson, photographer and cartographer.
And in this series, we explore the history, cultures, and cuisines of Malaysia, from the ancient lands of Southeast Asia all the way through to the creation of a modern-day nation. And in today's episode, we look at kuih and the unlikely Dutch affair. So, sweeten those lips, because it's time for Sate.
Okay.
So in the last episode, we took at Malacca in the 16th century. And at that time, Portugal invaded, took over Malacca, and then the Sultan of Malacca fled and set up a new residence in Johor.
Where he had routinely tried to come back and retake Malacca, what, nine times?
Many, many times, yeah. He was very persistent.
Well, quite right. It was his claim.
Today, we're continuing that journey into the 17th century now with the arrival of a new European player in the region, and that is the Dutch VOC. But before we get into that, let's look at the food of the day, that symbol that connects us with the past, and that is kuih.
Kuih? No, that's Spanish.
So, Philip, do you know what kuih is? Well, you know what kuih is.
I've been introduced to kuih.
Do you think people know what kuih is?
No, I don't think they do.
Yeah.
I don't even know that our expert today could actually articulate what kuih is.
Yeah, kuih is one of those foods that is really not easy to translate into the Western language.
Right.
So, in order for us to all figure out what kuih is, we thought we'd first take you to our guest of today, Christopher Tan from Singapore. So Christopher Tan is a bona fide kuih master. He's the author of the brilliant book, The Way of Kuih. So if anyone's gonna be able to help us with defining kuih, it's Christopher Tan. So let's hear from him.
It is a tricky one. There's no exact cognate with anything in the Western world. Okay, my name is Christopher Tan. I am a Singapore-based cookbook author, cooking instructor, food writer in general, you know, food history nerd, all these things. The word kuih itself comes from a southern Chinese dialect, okay? But because of migration throughout the Southeast Asian region, over the last few hundred years, the word kuih got absorbed into Bahasa Melayu and Bahasa Indonesia. Although there are other words for the same kind of food there as well. Kuih has probably the most widespread usage across the region. But it refers to, see, even snack doesn't quite sum
it's
it up.
It's not right.
Because
yeah.
Kuih can be sweet, it can be savory, yeah. It can be steamed, it can be fried, it can be pan fried, yes. It can be fermented, it can be baked. It's a very wide and broad genre of food. Many kuihs are associated with special occasions, festival times or seasons. But they are a distinct genre in that while they might be served during the course of a meal, they stand outside the meal a little bit. They have their own corner of the cuisine and the culture. I would say portion wise mostly they are small, but again small is subjective.
All right, so that was Christopher Tan attempting to describe what kuih is. I'm not actually sure if we got to a definition in the end. Christopher is one of those people who knows so much about kuih that every time he comes across what he thinks is a good definition, he can probably think of something that doesn't quite fit.
Yeah, it's the opposite of Dunning-Kruger. It's that bell curve of like, the more you know, the less you think you know. I try to kind of like anglicize like what in my experience of it has been, because it is sweet and savory, as he says, and it is sometimes soft and jelly-like, but also sometimes baked or like deep fried, which those two things don't quite, they don't naturally make you think of one type of food group, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I usually think of kuih as a sweet or savory snack that's often served in small, discrete portions.
Discreet.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I've got visions of these like Victorian and Georgian women in their big ball gowns like hiding themselves eating tiny like petit fours or something like that.
Petit fours, yeah, are definitely a type of kuih.
So from a Western point of view, it made me try to think what food it reminded me of. And the best I could think of is when you're in primary school, certainly in the early primary ones and twos, when you end up inviting your entire class of 30 students to go to a gym hall somewhere and run about for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
The party food that we get served would be like little slices of cakes, like little kind of like French fancies, or maybe even like an Empire biscuit, actually, or millionaire shortbread cut up into little things, or shortbready things. But then it also in Australia, you've got fairy bread, which is that not quite typically cut up into wee snack size? But
yeah, your triangles of plain white bread with margarine and then hundreds and thousands sprinkled on top. So yeah, kuei is this very broad genre of food that's popular across Southeast Asia. Lots of different cultures have their own kuei. They can be sweet, they can be savory. The two kuei that always pop in my head when someone mentions kuei are, well, the first one is kuei lapis. So this is layers of coconut jelly alternating typically in like pink and white. Mm-hmm. It's very pretty. And it's given to you in like a small square or a diamond. And as a kid, you kind of take off layer by layer with your hands and eat it. So it's very, very fun to eat.
However, I've seen some people now that I've been trained in the ways of eating it, that just bite into it.
Yeah. Which, look, you can, but it's not that fun.
No, I'm trying to think what like chocolate bars and stuff like that we have over here, where there's a particular way that you're supposed to eat it. And then when you see some people eat it a different way, you're like, you're a fucking monster.
Oh, like a Kit Kat bar. If someone doesn't like
break snap them in half. What? Or worse, it's not just like the two finger one, it's the four finger one that's stuck together and somebody just bites into it and you can see the entire imprint of their teeth across the entire four channels.
Yeah.
Savagery.
Yeah, so if someone eats a kuei lapis with just one bite and doesn't peel it, that's like if someone just bites into a Kit Kat.
Yeah, it's also not a nice way to enjoy it. You want the experience like the chocolate and the wafer on an individual stroke. You also want to extend the eating experience of it.
Yeah. The other one I think about is something called onde onde. These are really small balls of dough that are kind of like mochi texture, but they're filled with palm sugar and then rolled in coconut. So you kind of pop it in your mouth, it explodes, and then this palm sugar syrup just like oozes. It's friggin' addictive and delicious.
Yeah, the gula melaka is pretty nice, especially when they're quite fresh, because like you boil them, right?
Yes.
So when they're still quite warm and you've tossed them around the kind of coating that you put them in, that's pretty good.
So yeah, those are probably the two that I think of. I'd say a lot of the sweet ones, traditionally, they've got either three flavors, pandan, coconut, and palm sugar. I think those three ingredients are pretty typical to a sweet kuei experience. And the way that people have used these three ingredients to make radically different dishes, I've always found quite admirable in kuei making. So kuei is a really vast category of foods, and that really tells you a lot about the many, many different cultural influences of kuei. The word may have come from southern China, but there are lots of kueis of Malay, Indian, influence, Portuguese, a lot of kueis there, Dutch, certainly English. But that does lead us to today's history lesson, where we're going to try and connect more of those influences with the point in time that they originated. So again, last episode, we looked at Malacca in the 16th century falling to Portugal. And then after Portugal arrived, a new European player came onto the scene. The Dutch Verenigde Oost-Indische Company, or the VOC. Apologies if I pronounce that incorrectly.
Well, as a Malaccan, I don't think you need to apologize.
I try hard to pronounce every language correctly.
Anyway, that is very gracious of you.
I try. So essentially, the VOC is the Dutch East India Company.
Mm.
So a little bit of backstory of who they are. The VOC are basically a really large trading company, but they weren't owned by a single person or a single family. They were owned by a collection of shareholders and essentially run by a board of directors. And the way that the VOC ran itself is basically how a lot of multinationals run themselves today.
Mm.
So the VOC is the blueprint for a lot of capitalism that you see today.
Mm. And we're talking at what, when was this? Early 17th?
So this was in the early 17th century that they formed.
Right.
So the shareholders, they weren't just like wealthy people.
Mm.
They also just included just ordinary middle-class Dutch people.
Right.
Because Amsterdam did have a stock market at that time and the VOC was floated on the stock market.
Right.
So it wasn't unusual for families to have shares in the VOC.
And from what I understand, at that point in time, the Dutch were the kind of the trading masters even within Europe. Like they were doing a lot of trade in the Baltic with fur and things like that. And so they already had a bit of a precedent for sea trade.
And I guess that's why the VOC formed, because you had all these disparate trading companies that were kind of competing with each other.
Mm.
So they decided to amalgamate into one bigger company so they weren't competing with each other anymore.
And probably having seen what Portugal were up to, wanted a slice of the action.
Exactly. So like other European nations, they were really, really interested in the spice trade.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to capture more of that spice trade for themselves. But unlike some of the other European traders, the VOC had quite a lot of power. So they were essentially an arm of the Dutch state. The VOC could make treaties, alliances, they could wage war, they could have their own army, they could erect forts, appoint governors, etc. The difference was, though, that they didn't have any accountability. So they didn't have to answer to the public, to voters, as it were. Not that there were voters back then.
Yep.
They just had to make money.
So a bit of a private militia that made money through trade.
Essentially, yeah. And so the VOC has this purpose to enter the spice trade. It has a lot of resources to do so. But unlike Portugal, who wanted to control trade in Southeast Asia, the VOC wanted to control not just trade, but also the production of spices. So they were going one step further in their ambitions. Mm. And a particular spice that they were interested in was nutmeg.
Mm.
At the time, nutmeg could only be found in one place, which was the Spice Islands of Indonesia, in particular the Banda Islands.
Yep.
So the VOC heads to the Banda Islands in the early 17th century. And at that stage, the Bandanese, the people of the Banda Island, they're already pretty established traders and merchants. They have a preference at this stage for trading with Chinese, Arab, and Javanese traders because they're giving them things that they actually want. So batiks, so cloths that are beautifully patterned, rice, sago palm, porcelain, and also medicine. These traders are also pretty nice. They respect their religion. They're not trying to push their religion.
Yeah.
They respect local customs. And they're also known for just like exchanging cultures in a friendly manner.
Right.
This is not something that the Dutch VOC is really about. Aside from their poor manners, their disrespect of the Bandanese people in general, they also don't really have anything that the Bandanese actually want. What they're trading mostly with are wool and velvet. And if you've spent any time in the tropics, you would know that those are two materials you do not want touching your body.
Yeah, I would say.
So the Dutch VOC aren't having much luck on the Banda Islands. But they want the chiefs of the Banda Islands to sign a contract to give the Dutch VOC a monopoly on the nutmeg trade.
Right. So effectively, this is a land grab at this point.
Yeah, they're really...
Or rather, a treaty dressed up as a... Or a land grab dressed up as a treaty.
Yeah, basically. So the treaty itself is written in Dutch. I do not believe that the chiefs can read Dutch.
Right.
Some of them end up signing it anyway because they don't want to offend the Dutch merchants.
I feel like there was probably also a lot of presence when you saw that many cannons pointed at you.
Exactly. And a lot of them did fear for their life and they feared that there would be a violent reprisal if they refused.
Right.
So some of them end up signing it, but they don't actually keep to the agreement, whether or not they understood it or not.
Right.
Naturally, the VOC are pretty pissed off by this. And in 1609, the Dutch tell them that you've broken your promise, we're going to build a factory and fort on your island.
Right, for processing and what have you.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Bandanese is pretty pissed off by this. And then they end up killing various members of the VOC forces.
Right.
This begins this back and forth between the VOC and the Bandanese. The VOC retaliate, they order a naval blockade and stop food from getting to the island. Effectively, they're starving the population of the Banda Islands.
Right.
This forces their chiefs, therefore, to surrender more formally and accept the terms of the treaty.
Right.
Of course, you know, people don't just let go of their grudges.
No.
And there are whispers that the Bandanese are planning to launch an attack against the VOC again.
Okay.
So in 1621, the Dutch VOC decide to do something about it. At this stage, it's helmed by a man named Jan Pieterszoon Koen. He, I want to use the C word, but I want to keep this a bit more PG.
Sure.
But he was quite an awful human being with little moral character. And he is quoted as saying, "We cannot carry on trade without war, nor war without trade."
Mm.
So he wants war on the Banda Islands. And so in 1621, he arrives with 13 ships and nearly 2,000 troops.
Right.
He captures, tortures, and eventually kills the ruling class.
Mm-hmm.
He then proceeds to destroy their homes. He rounded up entire villages, enslaved the people that lived there. He transported them onto ships where many died of starvation and disease. Out of an estimated 13 to 15,000 people on the Banda Islands, just 1,000 people remained. So in effect, Kun had ethnically cleansed the island.
Yeah, and I believe the people that were left behind were only left behind to carry on working on the plantations and things like that.
He replaced those people with other enslaved people that he could subjugate. And so with this move, he effectively did monopolize trade of nutmeg.
Yeah. I believe there are some traditions still practiced on the Banda Island to commemorate the anniversary of this massacre. I believe there's some sort of dance where I think five of the young boys dance with flowers in their mouths as if to symbolize their tongues being cut out and not having a voice and stuff like that. Wow. Yeah, I saw a bit of it in a documentary, and the people on the Banda Islands are still very much in mourning about the complete annihilation of their culture from 300 odd years ago.
Yeah.
It is not to be overlooked that one spice so sought after by Europeans caused so much hurt on the other side of the planet where it was being farmed.
Yeah, yeah. When we talk about the spice trade and the involvement of Europeans in the spice trade, we so often don't really acknowledge the impact of the local people.
Yeah, I mean, we're starting to reflect more on that now, and I think a lot of attention has been given to what happened with transatlantic business, but there was just as much destruction and genocide going on.
Yeah.
In the East as well.
Yeah. So I will say that there were some people in Kun's company that did resist and did not want to take part in this ethnic cleansing, and they were killed. There were some in the ruling class in Amsterdam that did object to Kun's methods in some way, but I don't think they did enough about it, because obviously it still happened.
Well, if the guy was a bit like Stalin, then you probably didn't want to cross him, did you?
But for all the cruelty that Kun enacted at the Banda Islands, for his actions of ethnic cleansing, he was given a promotion, because all that the people in Amsterdam cared about was money, and he delivered that. This act ends up kicking off a period in the 17th century known as the Golden Age of Dutch culture. All this money ended up flowing back to Amsterdam, to their shareholders, where science and arts thrived. People like Rembrandt, people like Vermeer, artists that we know today,
and are internationally still talked about.
Yeah, and still profited from, emerged at this time. And so it's really important that we make that connection, that the wealth that enabled the Golden Age in Holland was on the backs of Southeast Asians.
Yeah. I'm not going to be able to look at Girl with a Pearl Earring the same, am I?
Yeah. Exploitation fueled the Golden Age. Okay, so at this point, the Dutch VOC is making enemies left, right, and center. Author Stephen Bowen, who wrote the book The Merchant Kings, describes the VOC at this time as, quote, a trading enterprise that within its first two decades was in conflict with nearly every maritime nation in the world. So not only has it got enemies across Indonesia, but it's got a lot of enemies within English forces. Absolutely hates Portugal, absolutely hates Spain, and they basically want to oust everybody, particularly those that are active in the spice trade. And so this is where we now bring in our friends in Johor. So if we remember, the Sultan of Johor friggin' hates the Portuguese.
Right.
They burned his home down. And the rulers of Johor...
Not just burned his home down, they stole all of his treasure.
Yeah, they did everything.
Which then sank in the sea.
So the rulers of Johor had on 9 separate occasions tried to reclaim Malacca from Portuguese forces, but failed every time. But Philip, as they say, 10th time's a charm.
Right.
And the rulers of Johor end up partnering with the Dutch VOC. And in 1640, they launch a joint strike against Portuguese Malacca. And in the following year, they succeed in ousting Portuguese forces.
Right.
What an unlikely partnership. I mean, unlikely in some ways, but totally predictable. It's that classic phrase, the enemy of your enemy is my friend.
I guess so, but I can't imagine that the Johorians would have known what the Dutch had just committed in Banda.
Possibly, yeah.
And so I would imagine that they might not have been so quick to buddy up with the Dutch if it meant...
Yeah.
Well, who knows how it could have gone.
So the Dutch and the rulers of Johor end up jointly ruling Malacca from this point onwards.
Right.
And I think they're pretty cordial in their relationship because I think neither one really cares about Malacca as a trading port anymore.
It had lost its prestige after 100 years of Portuguese rule.
Exactly. Yeah. And Johor was rising as a trading empire, and the Dutch VOC had based themselves in Jakarta, which they had named Batavia.
Right.
So both Dutch and the Malay rulers of Johor were pretty happy with what they had, and so Malacca just toddled on. So the Dutch have left a pretty substantial imprint on Malaysia's culture today. If you were to go to Malacca, you would see a lot of heritage buildings all in red. So the old town is full of red brick buildings, old churches, clock towers, and those are all legacies of this unlikely partnership between Dutch and Malay rulers.
Yeah, you've got the Christchurch, which is ancient. Well, it's 1600s or something, isn't it? And then there's the Stadhuis, is that what they call it?
Yes.
The old kind of like administrative building.
Yeah. Yep. So some of the museums are in these old Dutch buildings right now as well. And it's one of the reasons why Malacca gained its World Heritage status by UNESCO. But we also have the Dutch Eurasian community. So last time we talked about the Portuguese Eurasian community, which is the Christang, but there's also Dutch Eurasian.
Right.
They're really not talked about much at all.
Yeah.
They're quite underrepresented.
Perhaps there might be more Dutch Eurasian people in Indonesia, given that that ended up being the main Dutch colony over there.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, there is a huge Dutch influence on the food. And so Dutch influences now start to make up what you can see as a very, very internationally influenced cuisine. At this point in history, you have Chinese, Indian, Arab, local Malay, the broader Nusantaran culture converging with Portuguese and Dutch culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this sort of mishmash of influences is best seen in something like Quay. So we want to find out a bit more about the stories behind Quay, the many different influences, and that was the original point of talking to Christopher Tan.
Right.
So let's continue our chat with the Quay master himself to hear what he has to say about the history and culture of Quay and where it's heading into the future.
And one thing that I'm always exploring and I love to highlight in my writing is how connected the world is because of, you know, migration over centuries and trade routes, oceanic silk route, the maritime silk route and the overland silk route.
Mm.
And also just how deep a single food's history can go.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you look at the basic ingredients of Quay's, rice, coconut, palm sugar, aromatics like pandan leaf, Indonesian spices. Mm. As long as you have a country with a coastline, they're going to have some kind of thing with coconut in it, some kind of thing with palm sugar, some kind of fermented fish, some kind of rice-based cooking method if they have rice paddies. So you see a lot of parallel evolution just because of that. And then if you look at Indonesia specifically, and the same is true of Malacca, that sort of whole Dutch colonial connection has led to a lot of kuehs in Indonesia being made with butter, cheese, dairy products, you know, which prior to the colonial colonials coming in were not super common, and now you know you find cheese in everything. I mean, you can get pineapple tarts where they mix cheese into the dough. No one bats an eyelid now.
Yeah.
At one point, you have to think, you know, people must have thought, oh, butter pastry, right? I mean, we were just talking about the Malaccan pineapple tarts.
Yeah.
That whole big flat format with the exposed jam and then the lattice on top, that's essentially a Dutch fruit tart miniaturized, you know?
Other than demonstrating just how connected the world is, the influence of Dutch and other European food traditions into Southeast Asia raises some really fascinating points about who is preserving whose culture. We spoke about this in context to kek lapis legit, a type of layer cake. With all these different influences, are there any generalizations you can make where you could say the Dutch clearly had an influence on this because it was a tart-based, or British had an influence on these types of quays because of this feature, or Indian influence because of this other feature? Are there any sort of hints like that?
In some cases, I mean, if it has butter and cheese in it and it's Indonesian, quite likely there is some Dutch influence.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote another article about spekuk, you know, kue lapis legit, which is very Indonesian, but clearly has developed in some way from a Dutch cake, even though there is now no extant Dutch layer cake in Holland like that.
It's almost interesting to think that the Indonesian kek lapis is the preservation of Dutch culture. Well, you know, if you think about it the other way.
Yes, kind of. I mean, it is known in Holland now. But if you look at the historical text, there are actually two types of lapis. There's one where you alternate plain and spiced batters. Mm-hmm. So it's brown, white, brown, yellow layers. And that is the more Dutch type. The more Indonesian type is only a single batter, and the layers are much thinner, and you have more layers in a given span of cake. So there are two distinct types.
While the connection between Holland and Southeast Asia is clear in some food items, it's not so clear in others. And there's some debate that rather than kwais being influenced by Dutch dishes, it's Dutch dishes that have been influenced by kwai.
There's one interesting example which I don't know about. I don't really know the answer to. We have a kwai called kwai chara chara or kyukara, a few different names. And it's basically a rice-based sweetened batter, and you drizzle it from a very thin nozzle into hot oil. The traditional implement was a coconut shell with a few holes bored in it, and then you drizzle it. And it forms like a nest of crispy thread in the hot oil. And it cooks into a pancake, and then you fold it up, and then you serve it. In Holland, in I think the Frisian region, they have something called a drabbelkoek, which is a sweetened batter, but wheat flour, not rice flour, and drizzled into hot lard, and it forms a nest. And you get a crispy cake. Yeah. So it's essentially it's a funnel cake, but the Asian version is much finer thread. It's almost like bihun.
That thin.
Yeah. But the resemblances between what they use in the Netherlands to drizzle it, you know, it's like a multi-funneled cone thing. It's just so tantalizing, but we don't know. You know, and I'm sure you know kue bolu, right?
Oh yes.
Kue bolu, the baked sponge cake. But baked, usually traditionally baked in brass pans here with different motifs, you know, flower motifs, seashells and things. People think that kue bolu, people think it comes from the Portuguese bolo, which just means cake.
Yeah.
My theory, it comes from the Portuguese pau de lo, which means sponge cake, specifically sponge cake, because kue bolu are sponge cake. If you look at the traditional spelling of kue bolu, it's bahulu, B-A-H-U-L-U, bahulu. If you say pau de lo softly and quickly, pau de lo, pau de lo, pau de lo, it elides into bahulu fairly easily. In Holland, again, in the sort of, I think, 15th or 16th centuries, they had cake pans to bake what they called evenwieltjes, which means equal-sized cakes. And what are the motifs in those cake pans? Yeah. Seashells, flowers. Yeah. Yeah. They look exactly like kue bolu pan.
Yeah.
But which came first? We don't know. Yeah. We literally don't know. Yeah. We know it was the Dutch who sort of refined that technique of casting brass pans to be put over a fire to bake things in. And so the kind of traditional brass pans that we use for a lot of kue in Indonesia probably comes from the Dutch. But in the case of kue bolu, the batter for the kue probably comes from the Portuguese. Yeah. Very egg-heavy, very sweet. So, you know, tangled web.
While some kues, like pineapple tarts, have a European origin that, when explained, make total sense, there are some kue origin stories that are far more unusual. Christopher talked about a kue called kue pie tea, much loved by the Chinese Peranakan community. But the origin of kue pie tea shows just how interconnected the world is.
We have a Peranakan kue called kue pai tea. So that is a fried batter pastry cup that's filled with a savory filling. Okay? And I just researched an article for it. That's American.
Oh.
Yeah. So the format of frying, dipping a mold into liquid batter and then into hot oil to deep fry, that we think dates back to Turkey some 400 or 500 years.
Oh, really?
And from Turkey, it spread to the rest of Europe. And then Scandinavian immigrants brought it to the States. And it's my theory that American expats brought it to Singapore in the 1920s, because before the 1950s, you don't read about it in Singapore media at all, right? And they had a Turkish name, and then they went to Scandinavia, and they were known as rosettes, okay? And you know kue rose?
Yes.
Is actually a rosette cookie. So kue rose are made in Scandinavia, but they're called rosetten, right? And then when they moved to the States, when the immigrants moved to the States from Sweden primarily, but also Denmark and Norway, they called them rosette cookies. And then the Americans pioneered many sort of slightly modern cup shapes, which they put things like cream vegetables, like a chicken pie filling in there, and they call them patty shells.
Oh.
Okay, and the molds were called patty irons. That, I think, then made its way over to Singapore.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at the earliest mentions of the dish and the tool in our early cookbooks and media, they're called kueh patty, after patty shell, right? Kueh patty.
Oh.
And then over the years, suddenly it became kueh paiti.
Yeah.
Because pat is not a syllable that you find in any Asian dialect, or any Chinese or Malay dialect, right? So, you know, patty shell became kueh paiti, because it's a kueh, right? Because it's bite-sized.
So what we think of this very traditional Singaporean kueh is actually American via Scandinavians
via Turkey.
And that's not the only influence from the Americas.
If you look at how buns are sold in a typical bakery in Indonesia or Malaysia or Singapore, where you see all the buns are there and you get your tray and you get your tongs and you select your buns. And at the same system in Japan as well, right? Mm-hmm. You know it's from Mexico?
Is it? How?
That's how a traditional Mexican bakery sells bread.
Because I think of that as such an Asian concept.
And this is really, I still don't know I don't know all the details of how it happened, but in Japan, many bakeries are called panaderias, which is of course a Spanish word. Except in Japan they say panaderia. So a lot of people from southern China migrated to Mexico to build the railways, and I can't remember exactly which decade this was in, but you know, over a century ago. And some of them, after the railroads were built, or after they were an underclass, certainly, a lot of them settled there. A lot of them went back to Hong Kong or to Macau, and because they had been living among the Mexicans, they felt at home in Macau because of the Portuguese history. And a lot of them brought back bread recipes and started baking them there. So I talk about this in my new book. You have things like the Mexico bun, and you have polo pao, which you know, pineapple buns, which have exact cognates in Mexico.
Yeah.
Exact, as in they look exactly the same.
Yeah.
They are made exactly the same. And I have to think that they brought back that whole
style of serving
bread as well.
Yeah.
And so people are only now starting to realize it.
With food so closely linked to one's culture and identity, I asked Christopher if people ever got defensive when learning that their favorite kueh has its origins elsewhere.
In my teaching and writing, I always take care to communicate the fact that you know, food grows from a community. Food doesn't come into being in a vacuum. It's from people passing recipes over back fences and people, you know, making food for their kampong and sharing it at festival time. So it's not like there is one traditional way of doing things and everything else is illegal. Someone who sort of lays down the law in that way does not know how culture works or how, you know, food history works. Food evolves just like any other thing, right? So I think a lot of people don't even give it a whole lot of thought. You know, they know maybe what their family makes, maybe they know what their neighbors make, you know, but they may not know where a particular step or comes from, or you know, to go back to pineapple tart, South American fruit, Indonesian spices, cooked down with Indonesian spices, wrapped up in Dutch butter pastry, right? And then, depending where you are, the garnish on the tart is different if you're Peranakan or Malay or Eurasian. Chinese Peranakans make pineapple tarts for Chinese New Year. Malays make pineapple tarts for Hari Raya. Eurasians make pineapple tarts for Christmas. Chetty Peranakans, Indian Peranakans, they make pineapple tarts for Diwali or Deepavali, as they call it here. But to me, the most fascinating thing about not just kuehs, but a lot of foods in our region is really how connected, how many threads come together into that dish, you know, or how far and wide the history of that dish goes. Frankly, the world is getting more fractured by the day. So anything we can do to tease out where unity lies, I think is great.
How should we connect then, like, I guess, there's so many people want to claim this kueh is mine, this kueh is mine, but given the shared history, the many different influences, how should we be thinking about kueh and identity and those sorts of topics, do you think?
Again, who owns English? Does England own English? All the different Englishes that are spoken around the world, with kueh certainly, and with many other things, curries, you know, sambals, so much is shared. So much is shared. So much overlaps, and there are so many dialogues and multi-logs, if that's the right word, to be had. You know, and there is this trend in the cookbook world now, particularly in the West, to have very, very deep ethnographic narratives attached to a cookbook, where people talk about their childhood in this country or within this culture, and how, you know, and whether they grew up and then moved somewhere else, or they were experiencing their own culture in diaspora, and how that changed their cooking. Many, many more cookbooks are being published with that kind of a shape and a narrative, which to me is great. I think we need to see more of that. We need to see more books drawing together threads of history and connection in this way.
Christopher Tan's knowledge of kueh is vast, and his enthusiasm for it is palpable, and really quite infectious. It's perhaps no wonder why he wrote an entire book on the subject. But telling the stories of kueh and encouraging people to cook kueh has a deeper purpose for him.
Eating around Singapore and just being a food writer and watching our food scene evolve, you know, and this in the sort of mid-2010s, I noticed a lot more interest in sort of Western pastry trends, and at the same time, I saw a lot of our traditional cake shops and kueh shops slipping out of the limelight a little bit. You know, they didn't occupy as much of the average person's mind share, to put it one way, as they used to. And as a cooking instructor, I noticed that fewer people seem to be cooking at home or cooking as often. And one of the things about kueh that is so special is that, you know, many kuehs are associated with special occasions, festival times, and because many of them require a lot of effort, it's a family activity. You get together, you make kueh for New Year or Hari Raya or Easter or Christmas. That didn't seem to be as high a priority in Singaporeans' lives. And then I saw a lot of old kueh shops closing down. I was like, you know, I grew up with it. I feel if I have the opportunity to write a book like this, then I really should. Because I wanted to read a book like this, a comprehensive book about kueh and the history across our communities, and I couldn't find one. And if you can't find it, you have to write it, right? Thank God I was in a good place to be able to write it. I got a grant from my Heritage Board to help support the project as well.
As we move to a more modern life, we see less and less traditional recipes cooked in the home. And so, in some ways, we're losing the ability to know what traditional kuehs are even supposed to look and taste like.
If, especially with traditional dishes, you have to really experience a really good version of it to know how good is good enough, right? And it's a mistake to think that all traditional cuisines are rustic. Chinese cooking, Peranakan cooking, a lot of it depends on very fine knife skill. You know, we are very particular about mouthfeels and textures, Thai food especially even, and things like fine balance between acid and salt and sweet. You know, just because a cuisine hasn't been codified in the way that French cuisine or Italian cuisine has been, just because it hasn't been codified in English, doesn't mean that it's not every bit as sophisticated. And this is true not just of kueh, but of many foods. I think when a food starts to get sold commercially, so that people don't need to make it at home anymore, but they can go out and buy it, okay? Certain compromises are always made to adapt a recipe to a commercial setting, okay? Because shops that sell food, they have overheads, they have a bottom line they need to meet, they have staff to pay, they have marketing to shell out for. And they get the ingredients from suppliers as opposed to going down to the wet market and buying everything, every single thing themselves. So there are different constraints to a commercial business than there are in a home kitchen. And this leads to necessary differences in the quality of the item. And I think if you never made something yourself, but you only have ever bought it, that affects your perception of how good that thing can possibly be. Because you've only experienced what you can buy. You assume that must be the best it can get, whereas that may not be true. You know, so when I in writing my kueh book and in teaching, I always tell people, if you put care and attention and love into it, what you make at home will be in a different room to anything you can buy. Just because you can spend time, you can spend money, you can invest effort and attention. So I think, you know, a key step is getting people to realize really how good something can be if you make it yourself. And sadly, the modern world is such that the way societies work now, you know, a lot of us are robbed of the time to cook at home in any significant way.
And so, for a man that has such a vast knowledge of kuei, what is his favorite?
I don't have one. Getting to know so many of them, you know, there are like 96 recipes in my book, and more that I couldn't even fit in. Getting to know all of them, they are kind of all like my children or my extended family. I can't pick one. There are kueis that are particularly meaning for me. I grew up making pineapple tarts and kueh bangkit with my grandma. So those are the ones that I have the strongest memories of, you know, but I love every one of them for their own particular identity and character.
Because they are your children in many ways.
Yes. You know, and I hope as many people as possible adopt them too, you know. As we said right at the beginning, it's a genre that is hard to explain and not widely appreciated outside our region. And I really hope they find their homes in more hearts. The more hearts any dish can find a home in around the world, the more likely that dish is to survive and persist.
You know?
So spread the food, spread the love.
So that was Christopher Tan, author of The Way of Kuei, which really is a brilliant book. It has so many recipes about so many different kueis. And if you were like me growing up eating the kueis, but you never knew how to make them, this is really the perfect book.
Yeah, no, it was an incredible, it's an incredible book, and it was incredible to sit there and listen to him talk. And he talks so knowledgeably about so many different facets, from the etymology to, he even made a point, which we didn't include in the interview there, about all of these recipe books coming out of Europe and what have you, but all of these fine cakes and what have you, and, you know, how long you're supposed to leave your bread to prove for, which, you know, living in Scotland, it's freezing cold, and even with the central heating on, it might say leave to prove for 30 minutes. And if you're a novice bread maker, that bread will not prove adequately for you to make a decent loaf of bread. And it took me the longest time to realize, oh, actually, the best method for me in a controlled environment is to leave it for like a 12-hour proof in a fridge overnight.
Well, Scotland is cold.
Right. And so therefore, Christopher's on the opposite end of the spectrum where it is hot and humid, and he might have to leave something out for 25 minutes and it's completely ready to go.
Yeah.
And so he talks about how, I think in the setup of the book, he talks about, I have written this book in this kitchen in this part of the world with these as the ambient temperatures.
Yeah, I've got it here that he developed these recipes a mere 1 degree north of the equator, where daytime room temperatures range from 27 to 34 degrees, nighttime temperatures from 25 to 30 degrees, and humidity ranges from 70% to 90%.
So when Christopher describes himself as a bit of a baking nerd, that's the kind of level of nerdship that I think I actually really kind of respect and admire, because there is no one size fits all when you're making things that need to ferment and things like that. So, you know, I think having that context in there really actually, for someone like me who likes to get a bit in about it, was relevant and valuable context.
Well, he's also got two other books. One is called Nerd Baker.
All right.
And the sequel, Nerd Baker 2, which is also called Tales from the Yeast Indies, tells you a lot about Christopher Tan's love of the pun.
Yeah.
The Way of Kuei and the East Indies.
No, he was quite incredible to listen to, just given how knowledgeable he is, and how he every single thing, the fact that he sort of delivered it was then also reference based in some sort of a way where you could talk about those bakeries in Mexico, which, you know, having, you know, the time spent in Adelaide, you know, there was plenty of like Chinese bakeries, and I think Glasgow might have one or two kicking about, but I was like, why is there a hot dog bun? Like, how did this end up in a Chinese bakery? Like, what's going on here? Is this some interwar thing? But to learn that it actually comes from bakeries in Mexico, quite mind-blowing.
It does make you realise how interconnected we all are, as he mentioned, but also how deep our food history can go. And that really everything that we eat today can tell us something about the past.
Right.
And so everything that we eat is an opportunity to engage with our own history and culture in a different way. And that's, I think, what fascinates me about food and why I got into food writing and this podcast.
Yeah, I think if you have any sort of an imagination, it's quite easy to then sit there and think about how the Portuguese went to Central America and discovered chilies, and like we said in the last episode, and brought them around and was able to introduce chilies to make sambal and eventually things like rendang or whatever. And Yeah, there's when you think about the fact that this global trade has existed, well, when I say global, I mean entirely global, from the Europeans coming into Southeast Asia, you now have a global trade network that has been going for 500 years. It's not something that only came about with the invention of containerization and like post-war, you know, or Panama Canal even. Like, you know, people were taking the long way around to get to these places for the longest time. So
the chat with Christopher Tam was super, super interesting, and we had a very, very long chat. And we will be throwing back to Christopher Tan in later episodes of this series. If you're enjoying this episode, you can follow us on social media at SateOK. We'll be sharing beautiful photos taken by Philip of Malaysia, its people, and of course, the food. We'll also share photos of Malaysia from the archives, so you can see how the country has changed over time. You can also find links to give us a tip or donation to show your appreciation for the work we're doing. So head to our socials at SateOK or visit our website, sateok.com. So Christopher did mention that traditional kuih making is on the decline, unsurprisingly, just like many other food customs across Southeast Asia and the world.
Right.
And so we wanted to get the perspective from traditional kuih makers. And so we spoke to Noura Azura. She is based in Malacca, and she runs a kuih business called Kuih Kriya Antarabangsa. We got her perspectives on how to run a thriving kuih business.
No, I'm nervous. My name is Noor Azura. I am the daughter-in-law of Haji Jalil. Kuih Kriya. How do I explain it? This Kuih Kriya is made from sweet potatoes. Yes, made from sweet potatoes. Ours is different from others. We use 80% sweet potatoes compared to flour. Our kuih has more sweet potato in it.
Kuih Kriya is like a sweet potato donut. We visited the shop and watched as they cooked sweet potato, mashed it, added flour to make a dough, and then shaped that into small discs. These were deep fried and then coated in a palm sugar syrup. It's a classic Malay kuih and very addictive to eat. Azura's business, though, didn't actually start with her.
The idea came from my father. Originally, my father was a fisherman. The idea at first was to sell in the village. Then, as it got tastier, the demand kept growing. The first shop is this shop, right behind here. That used to be our original shop site. We fried the kuih using firewood. When frying using firewood, it actually tastes better. How do I say it? The flame is just right. The kuih turns out beautifully. The kuih looks nice. Tastes great too. Then we moved next to the mosque. Firewood became harder to find. With firewood, moving it around, transporting it, but higher cost. It's the cost, right? That's when we switched to gas.
A few years ago, the business was featured on a TV show, and all of a sudden, sales boomed.
Now since we got featured on Majalah Tiga, people of all races have started coming here. Now, from Canada and all Taiwan. Everywhere, because it's like donut, familiar taste, even from Thai. After appearing on Majalah Tiga, before that, I only sold 2,000 pieces a day. Before, it increased to 10,000, and now we can't even keep up. We had to, me, my sisters, one of them a former factory manager at TDM, two of them were teachers, all quit. We opened together, but it's not enough. We can't serve all the customers. Nearly 10,000 now we are making. 10,000 pieces per day per shop. You count one shop here, another over there, three shops.
The expansion of her business is astounding. So much so that other members of her family quit their day jobs to open up more shops. And the secret to their success? Well, there literally are no secrets.
It went viral. Many people started selling too. We just gave up the recipe. But even then, the taste still aren't the same. We are all totally open about it. Right in front of people, we don't keep secrets. I have no secrets. Open, you can see it. People can watch. If they ask, we tell them how to make it. But still.
It's really astounding that one kuih has changed the fortunes of this whole family.
People come here. They say things like, you only sell kuih? You rent both upstairs and downstairs? How much is the rent? 4,000 ringgit? Can you afford that just by selling kueh? Some people doubt us. Can you really afford renting to floor just selling kueh? Now I pass it on to my children. Now my daughter's doing it. My son too. We've taught them. Like my sister, she used to work in a factory, big salary, all quit to the business. The first one, she was a university manager. Number two was a teacher, also quit to the business. Number three had a diploma in law, quit too.
And that was Noor Azura with English dub by Anindya Kenyo Larasti. So Philip, I found it very refreshing to talk to someone whose traditional food business was thriving.
Yeah, I'm quite conscious the last couple of episodes, whoever we've spoken to, it's always just been a bit kind of like sad and lamenting about this declining kind of culture. But here you have this Malay tradition of cakes and donuts, effectively, that are booming, that, you know, you have all of these highly qualified professionals in the family. But yeah. I don't know, it kind of resonates with me in a bit of a way that you kind of get a bit sick of the corporate life and actually all you want to do is just hang out with friends and family and make cakes all day. And the fact that they're having a success story, I thought was quite inspiring. I was kind of like, well, I don't know that I'm going to open a bakery anytime soon, but you know, it'd be nice to do your own thing.
It was inspiring to hear that members of her family had jobs as lawyers or teachers or whatever, and then quit that job to come join the family business. Because often you hear the opposite, that the parents don't want their children to take over the business because it's too hard. So they send them for university or education.
Right.
They get jobs elsewhere and then they never return. And so this was total 180, which I thought was amazing.
Yeah.
And I think it also goes to show that young people aren't afraid to work hard. I think sometimes society treats young people as these like really lazy people that just want to sit on the couch and they just want to do easy work. Like, quay making is not easy work. Mm-hmm. But when there is an economic incentive, when business is good, young people are willing to work hard. They just want to be paid equitably for it.
I dare say that might also be a symptom of Western capitalism and the service-based economy that we have over here, that it's actually just not very fulfilling. And to have your hands dirty, covered in sweet potato and flour and all of the rest of it, but you're just standing there idly gossiping, listening to the radio or whatever while you're making tens of thousands of donuts every single day.
Yeah.
Actually, maybe you you wash your hands at the end of the shift and you go home and you feel quite content instead of coming home and reaching for a bottle of gin. You know, it's that sort of way is kind of like, perhaps actually in the West we're all miserable because we hate our office jobs because we're human and we're not supposed to be in air-conditioned rooms constantly.
They weren't the only businesses that we did speak to that felt like that. You know, we spoke to a biscuit manufacturer and they were telling us how their sons took over the business because there was economic opportunity. They could expand the business, they had their own ambitions, but it was all centered around their family's biscuit recipe.
Which is what, 100 odd years old or something, wasn't it? Yeah. It's kind of those shortbread things, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they were delicious.
I was also talking to a friend of a friend in a place called Seremban, and they were saying that post-COVID, you did see some young people open up hawker stalls because COVID made them realize they hated their day job, they hated their office job, and would rather work for themselves.
Yeah, what's the opening bit in the video game Stardew Valley?
Yeah.
Where he literally, like, there's this, like, really, like, impactful sort of statement at the beginning of this guy who, well, the character in the game anyway, that leaves the office and goes to start up a farm, which I thought, when I remember reading it, I kind of had my hands going, oh God, that is me.
Too real.
Yeah. But I really liked her comment about the transparency of the business that she was sharing the recipe. You know, she, like when she talks about how kind of transparent it all is, you walk into this large kind of airy restaurant and you see the ladies up the back just with these huge, huge bowls of just like the kind of mash that they're sitting there forming up and shaping and putting on their trays, the cauldron of this huge wok that was probably almost a meter in diameter, just boiling.
Very scary.
With oil, with all of these donuts just bobbing away in the top of it. And you're kind of like, God, it only would take one splash of oil to go over the side of that.
I was too scared to really get anywhere near that.
Yeah, having been to enough like chip fan fire kind of demonstrations about what not to do in the event of it. And, you know, we're not cooking like that domestically.
There were three generations at that table all working with the dough together. And it was quite nice to see.
And they all looked happy.
Yeah. Philip did take some really beautiful photos of this place and we'll post them on social media, so do check that out.
Yeah.
But back to our food of the day, back to quay. When I think about quay, I think of something that is probably complex to define because I'm often trying to explain it to other people. But that complexity tells you a lot about the many different cultural influences of quay. And that's reflected in Malaysia's really complex history when it comes to maritime trade, people sort of moving back and forth between the many islands of the archipelago, and also just the influences from all over the world. So when you try some quay, when you think about quay, think about the very many different influences that Malaysia has experienced over many, many centuries.
No, it's... the plot is thickening.
Okay, so now if we turn our attention back to history, and let's go back to our friends in Johor. With Portuguese forces expelled from Malacca, Johor begins to rise in power. And so by the end of the 17th century, things are looking pretty good for them.
Okay.
That all changes though in 1699. So at this point, Johor is ruled by a boy sultan, Sultan Mahmud Shah II.
Okay.
If anyone has watched Game of Thrones, there are a lot of parallels between this sultan and Joffrey Baratheon. The sultan is pretty much uncontrollable. He doesn't really care about the trade empire that he's ruling. And under his rule, trade suffers. He only really seems to care about himself and satisfying his own urges and predilections. And by all accounts, his behavior was very cruel and evil and sadist.
Right.
I cannot read to you the list of crimes that the Sultan committed because they are too heinous and too violent.
Yeah, the trigger warning. This is a family show.
Yeah. But yeah, there are really a lot of parallels with Joffrey Baratheon in their age, in their character, and in their life circumstances, I suppose.
Yeah, no, the cruelness of this one individual's actions is quite galling.
Yeah. So Johor has this renegade boy sultan, and after tolerating his behavior for a little while, the nobles decide that they can't really sit idly by. Whether they're motivated by economics or morality, probably uncertain, probably a bit of both,
I would imagine.
And so in 1699, when the Sultan was on his way to the mosque, a group of nobles descended upon him and one by one they stabbed him. Sultan dies, obviously.
Yep.
So when you assassinate a Sultan though, there are consequences.
Regicide.
And when you consider that this particular Sultan was a boy, he had no direct descendants to the throne, those consequences start to become magnified. And just a reminder that the Sultan of Johor can trace his lineage to the Sultanate of Malacca and then can trace that lineage to the Sultanate of Srivijaya before it.
Oh, okay.
So now you have this very, very long line of sultans that has been broken. And so what follows this regicide is a monumental tussle for power, not unlike Game of Thrones.
Power vacuum, not another one. Yeah.
Yeah, it's becoming a running theme of Nusantara, isn't it?
Yeah, power vacuums and family squabbles. Yeah. Yes.
And so it's these events that we're going to explore more in the next episode entitled Laksa and the Great British Lie.
Okay.
It's like we're combining the Great British Bake Off with traitors.
Uh-huh. The Great British Trade-Off. Maybe that's...
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
So join us for the next episode of Satay.
Okay.